Welcome to Native America Calling. From our studio in Albuquerque, I'm Andy Murphy. Appropriation happens when a person works to become an expert and even make money off of a culture that isn't theirs. It's a problem for many Native American cultures, and it takes consistent vigilance to fight. Appropriation can happen in the kitchen as well, when non-Native people popularize indigenous recipes and tradition as a marketing concept. How rampant is food appropriation, and how does it affect indigenous chefs? We'll talk about that after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An alliance of tribal leaders from the United States and chiefs of First Nations from Canada came together Tuesday in Rapid City, South Dakota, to oppose the Keystone XL pipeline and tar sands expansion. On the 4th of July, tribal leaders signed agreements to also oppose the Dakota Access Pipeline and to stop the Interior Department from removing Yellowstone grizzly bears from the endangered species list. A representative from Manitoba tells Victoria Wicks that 150 years of treaty violations have led to environmental destruction.
Kevin Hart is the Manitoba Regional Chief for the Assembly of First Nations. He says First People in Canada, as in the United States, entered into treaties with the federal government. He says those legal agreements were created to ensure the welfare of all so that all people could share resources and thrive. But now, he says, Indigenous people in both nations live in abject poverty.
Obviously, that's a direct breach of the treaty because, you know, we're living in third world conditions, and yet corporations and federal governments reap from the benefits of the extraction of all the natural resources that we see occurring on the lands and the water.
Hart says even though treaties and constitutions require it, federal governments don't consult tribes before allowing land to be disturbed for pipelines, hydroelectric power, and mining. He says in Canada those developments have disrupted fishing and hunting industries in remote locations, resulting in elevated food prices and poor nutrition. And he notes that the United States is the leading customer for Canadian exports.
It says in our prophecies, you know, after the last tree's been cut down, after the last water has been polluted and such, after the last animal has been killed off, they said, you'll realize that you can't eat money.
Through efforts of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and other government-to-government accords, Hart says First Peoples' voices are heard more widely and their rights are recognized globally. But he says time is running out for protecting the planet. The alliance includes representatives of the Blackfoot Confederacy, the Great Sioux Nation, and the Ponca Nation. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Five members of the Canadian military are in hot water and have been relieved of their duties pending an investigation. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the group disputed an Indigenous ceremony on Canada Day.
This is Mi'kmaq territory. This is not Canada.
This is Canada.
You
it might have been. It might have been Mi'kmaq.
So you don't have Canadian ID. You don't pay your taxes. You don't have a Medicare card.
This is not an argument.
Well, it is.
It wasn't exactly an altercation, it wasn't violent, but it was improper, according to Canada's most senior military officials, and especially for members of the Canadian military who serve their country. The group was dressed the same in black polo shirts with yellow piping, and they carried the Canadian Red Ensign flag, the country's national flag, until it was replaced by the Maple Leaf in 1965. They also said they were members of the Canadian chapter of the Proud Boys. That's a group that claims it will no longer apologize for creating the modern world and won't discriminate on the basis of race or sexuality. A Mi'kmaq woman, Rebecca Thomas, was at the ceremony and witnessed the event.
I was nervous. I was very nervous as to what could happen, right? If you have, young, brash men and passionate protesters coming together, that doesn't always have a happy ending.
In a statement from Ottawa, Canada's Chief of Defence Staff, Jonathan Vance, apologized to the Indigenous community, saying also that he detests any action by the Canadian forces that is intended to show disrespect towards the very people and cultures we value in Canada. And the Minister of Defence said there would be consequences for military personnel in or out of uniform who express intolerance. The Mi'kmaq ceremony took place in Halifax in front of the statue of Edward Cornwallis, who was the founder of the city and its first governor, but who was also responsible for declaring a controversial bounty on Mi'kmaq scalps in the mid-1700s. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, we know what it means to be rooted in community. You can get your Master's of Social Work and amplify your voice without having to leave it. The part-time online program accepts applications between August 1st and 31st. More at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. In May, a pop-up restaurant called Cook's Burritos shut down after the owner said they stole tortilla recipes from women in Mexico. The fact that the little eatery shut down so fast shows that people are paying attention to appropriation when it happens in the kitchen. Appropriation of Native American food is relatively rare. Many non-Native people still don't have a clear idea of what Native food is. We'll talk later this hour about a Native-themed restaurant with non-Native owners and staff. Also this hour, we'll talk about how Native communities and Native chefs are affected by appropriation in the kitchen. And we want to hear from you, too. How does appropriation inside and outside of the kitchen affect you and your Native community? Is there a benefit for exposing Native food to a broader customer base? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we have Claudia Cerato joining us. She is an anthropologist, professor, and chef. She's Purepecha. Welcome to Native America Calling, Claudia.
Hi, thank you.
All right. Thank you for joining us. So let's start off with maybe a definition of appropriation. What is your definition of appropriation in the kitchen?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Because I've been thinking a lot about appropriation and what that means. And, you know, also looking at, you know, what it represents and how people are writing about it, even within, you know, urban dictionary and urban meaning, right? And I want to say, you know, I side with thinking about it more in terms of cultural misappropriation. And, you know, in reference to the kitchen, I feel that in order to define that, you know, it is important to think about it in terms of the cultural experience, because there is a lot of debate as to whether or not one can actually cook food that isn't part of their culture. And I personally feel that, I mean, anybody can pick up a recipe book, you know, and you can follow it along, you know, to the best of your ability, right? But I feel that it becomes an appropriation or a misappropriation when one begins to claim that they have that cultural knowledge. Some folks refer to it as intellectual property rights. And you want to take that and you want to create, you know, recreate it as if it's always been yours. And I feel that when that occurs, then, you know, when one is trying to claim a food menu or food item and without it understanding the genealogy that's involved in that process, in that food making process, then it becomes a moment of appropriation because you are not, respecting it within its proper historical and landscape meaning making and what that takes on within a cultural context, you know? So unless it is a lived experience, something that you are engaged in from, you know, from time immemorial or from, you know, your engagement in the kitchen, at whatever age that is, and, you know, you're in there doing the work and you're understanding, you know, the bodily processes that are involved and the relationships that are occurring and reoccurring and establishing themselves, and you know, you dismiss all that and you just take on food and say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's Native American or it's Indigenous or it's Mesoamerican, and you want to represent it that way, and like the way you shared, you know, it becomes this sort of marketing tool, you know, which romanticizes, you know, this idea of what Indigenous food is. You know, then I feel that not only is it being appropriated, but it's also being misappropriated because it's being disrespected. So there really isn't a clear definition because it's just a lot of things. Like everything is in relation. Like you really can't take one thing from another and break it apart that way because it's all encompassing. And so I feel when we're thinking about this in terms of food, you know, it could be definitely misrepresented. And also, too, you know, as a Native chef, you know, some of our recipes are also very much in relation. So, you know, that also, too, can be misrepresented. And, you know, some of our foods tell our stories. And so then, yes, it's okay to recreate stories, but when they are told in a way that does not honor, you know, the story-making processes and also to our histories, then it becomes a dishonoring, right. a moment of dishonor. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when you heard about Cook's Burritos in Portland, what did you think of it? Does it fit any of these kind of definitions of appropriation here?
Well, you know, so as an anthropologist, like mm-hmm. we're trained, you know, that you need to, you know, live with a community and you know, become part of the everyday reality and you know, you put your time in and you build relationships. And from my understanding and just, you know, from the little that I've been following of that, because as soon as I heard, you know, burritos, soul recipes, I was like, oh, this is just another, you know, something that has always happened, you know, with culinary imperialism. And so for me, it's just, oh, this is just another product of the 500 years of violence against our foods. Like, this is not a new story. This has been happening since then, since the moment of the colonial encounter. But I will say that, you know, what made it really problematic for me is just how the women involved were referring and just really demeaning those that created these particular recipes and saying, oh, you know, we got them from, you know, these Mesoamerican, these, you know, Indigenous women. And that's not usually how recipes are passed down. Like, you got to put in the work, right? And so for me, it was really about, you know, were these women really just, you know, being, what does a term for it? It has to do with, like tourism. Mm-hmm. And you know, just being these tourists, really. And then just because, you know, one tastes food and asks a question, oh, did you put salt in this? Did you put this in it? It doesn't mean, oh, these recipes were passed down to you. So, again, that already I thought was already a process of that misappropriation where, you know, and that's not usually how recipes are passed down. Yeah. I mean, you know, just in my own experience, like I, you know, participate and I taste the food and I engage in the culture and I engage in the social, you know, activities involved in you know, the food gathering processes and the, you know, the grinding of the corn. I mean, because I myself grind my own corn. I nixtamalize it. Like, it's a whole process. And for somebody to just come in and say, hey, what's your recipe? Like, that's not how it works. Mm-hmm. Like, you just don't do that. You know, you have to engage the body, the senses, and to not, you know, to not engage oneself that way, you know, speaks to that culinary imperialist practice that has been an ongoing practice within, you know, contemporary food traditions. And, you know, so that was really problematic for me, at least, in understanding, you know, what this meant. And then also, too, right, I mean, just the burrito itself. If the burrito is something, it's a commodity food. It's not, you know, it's flour. That's not really something that is, you know, part of our everyday lived experiences, especially in Mexico, you know, and, you know, just the marketing aspect of it, again, right, it romanticizes this idea of indigeneity without really respecting it. And so, yeah, I felt that the food itself was being disrespected, but most of all, the women of these homes, the homemakers, the ones that have been carrying these recipes, like, they were, I just felt like it was a huge disrespect to them and their, you know, cultural and ancestral memory.
Right, right. And I read that these women, they were on their Christmas vacation in Mexico, and they went to a couple of women there in the town they were in. I forget which town, but they did ask questions, and they did ask questions of a couple of different women. And when they didn't get what they wanted or when they were pushed away, they actually went and peeked in some windows and started, you know, taking secret notes and, you know, sneaking around and taking some of these recipes. So that is definitely problematic. And everybody in social media, in the food world, really kind of jumped on them. And looks like that pressure, you know, broke them, because they were just out in the open, in the public, like, hey, you know, we went around stealing recipes, and here's our restaurant. And you know, we'll see what comes out from that. But there are a lot of other restaurants that haven't been addressed, a lot of other chefs whose process of taking or appropriating recipes hasn't been addressed. But Claudia, when you are cooking food, cooking recipes from your mom and your grandma, how special are these recipes really coming from, you know, generations before you? It seems like maybe people are not understanding that part of it, how important they are to our story and our family history.
Yes. Just you asking that question made me want to cry.
No.
because they are, I mean, they're life. It's my life. Like, I, for example, like, I feel that it's part of my identity. And, you know, for recipes to be passed down, And you know, and yes, you know, they're going to change, of course, right, as our taste palates are changing. But nonetheless, it's an original recipe. And you know, the process of preparing it, like all of that is very telling, because it's a way to be connected, right? Like for me, you know, I feel very connected to my mother's mother when I'm cleaning my beans out, right? Because there's a particular way to do that. There's a particular way, you know, in understanding the frijol. You know, if one falls, you know, I was told, oh, that bean is crying. It's sad that it's no longer with its family. So I pick it up and I rinse it, you know, like there's these little things that we do and, you know, the different ingredients that we put into the food, because, you know, there's another recipe or another ingredient that we don't really talk about, which comes from love, right? Like how we put that into our recipes. And, you know, when I think about my family recipes, you know, I think about, you know, the cultural gatherings, what brings around these particular recipes. I think about, you know, the landscape. I think about those flavors. And I think about, you know, the bodily processes involved and how I'm also engaging in those processes that my ancestors, you know, were engaged in the process of recipe making. And then the new stories that they begin to carry, right? Because food also is an embodier, and it carries, you know, the knowledge of the land, the knowledge of the stories, and you know, also to the elements of the sun and fire, all of these that are engaged in that cooking making process. And, you know, in my family, when we're working with recipes, like we understand and respect the recipe, but also to the ingredients, because these ingredients is the life force. These ingredients are teachers, right? They teach us about resilience, and they teach us about life-giving, and you know, and then with that, we create meaning, right? So we have this symbolic meaning, which then we're able to pass down to the next generations, right? And the way that we go about in doing that, which is, you know, through the recipe preparation, through the tasting of the food, through the sensory experience of the food. And then, you know, eventually it becomes, you know, encoded in our genetic memory, right? So we understand that this is all, you know, cyclical. This is a cycle. This is like a cycle. This is part of the cycle of life. This is an ecology, right? Some folks call this traditional ecological knowledge. And, it, you know, it also happens in the kitchen, right? It doesn't just end outside in the landscape, because that enters our home. And, you know, so there it's, you know, my family recipes are very, very dear to me, and they're dear to my existence. And I know because of that, it's very important to my next generation, to my offsprings, to my seedlings. and, you know, to keep these recipes going, and, you know, to change them up as we're learning more about GMOs and, you know, all these different modifications that are happening, right? We need to, I don't want to say keep them pure, but, you know, protect them, right? Which is why we have our heirloom seeds and so forth, where we want to do our best to protect them so that they maintain its integrity and also to its, you know, ancestral flavors.
Right. You mentioned cookbooks a while ago, and I always found cookbooks pretty interesting, especially when we're talking about our family recipes and our ingredients that are very close to us. But then, you know, some of us end up making cookbooks where we share all of these family recipes, and maybe even we called them secrets at one time. What do you think about cookbooks, just laying it all out there for people to cook and maybe even start up a restaurant based on your cookbook that you wrote of your family recipes?
Yeah. You know, so when I think about, okay, so I enjoy cookbooks. Mm-hmm. You know, they're fun. They're fun to look at. You know, they tap into my creativity. Like I use cookbooks for inspiration. And once in a while, I myself will try some recipes, but I alter them. I feel that cookbooks are an invitation to enter the kitchen. I feel that they're an invitation to test out your, you know, your culinary skills, right? And for some folks, they like to stick to it to the T, and, you know, that's great. But I feel that it's like a platform where then you can begin to, you know, change up some recipes or alter some recipes, right? Or, oh, well, this is how I would make this. I do not feel, and I don't believe that, all cookbooks and all recipes are always going to have all the major ingredients in there. Like, I know in my family, we make a particular mole. And in our mole, my mom says, mija, when you pass out, you know, the recipe, like, it's very important that, you know, you don't share everything. and I always tell her, well, Mom, even if I did put some of the ingredients that we use, I still don't feel it's going to taste the same. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, and also too, you know, when it comes to sharing recipes too with people, like, you know, close intimate, my community, I don't have a problem sharing that when it's within my community. Or when I share recipes with the Native Chef world, right? Like, 'cause that's what we do. We teach each other a skill set. So I feel that it's about building our skill sets, you know, allowing us to explore, but to claim it and to want to open a restaurant using somebody else's recipes, I mean, that's just straight, you know, that's just a thievery. Like, you just, there should be like an ethic, right? Like, there's a code of ethics, and I just feel like there's folks that doesn't matter, right? That doesn't matter to them because they don't have ethics, right? So I, you know, I do feel that it's a really good way to hold on to some recipes and to be able to pass it down to, like, you know, the communities or to the pueblos or to clans or to, you know, the next generations. But to, you know, want to create a whole restaurant out of somebody else, you know, who have done that work, who have those memories, who have those stories is just wrong. I really do see that as misappropriation.
All right. Thanks, Claudia. Let's bring in Carlos Baca. He's an indigenous food chef, and he's Tiwa, Diné, and Ute. Hey, Carlos, welcome back to Native America Calling.
Hey, how are you doing this morning, Andy? Thanks for having me.
All right. We are doing good. Claudius brought us right to this, right out of the gate here. You were recently in, I would say, Facebook conversation, social media conversation with another place, the herb farm. Can you tell us what that was about? That's another example of food appropriation.
Yeah, it was just strolling through the social media, and I noticed that a friend of mine, Britt Reed, had posted about this place called the Herb Farm, and they were doing a week-long tasting dinner called Taste of the Totems, where they were going to do indigenous foods of the Northwest. And she had opened a dialogue about it. And I see people discussing it, but I had not you know, seen anybody like going into the website itself. So I went over there and gave it a look, and what I saw was that they, let's see what the statement was. They were resurrecting these traditional indigenous foods in the Northwest. And I was, you know, my response to them was, I said, oh, did we all stop eating or die? You know, they erased my comment. And so I brought it back to the social media atmosphere and I said, so this just happened. I think we should go ahead and just start this thread over there. And the outcome of that was a pretty healthy dialogue. You know, this is what started this entire conversation for me, you know, prior to the you know, prior to our first conversation, just the lack of ethic and not knowing anything about indigenous food and culture, you know, like to assume that you are going to resurrect something that has never went anywhere. You know, like how distant do you have to be to even attempt to do something like that, you know? And then when you're confronted with it, to delete the comment until it brings a firestorm upon you, you know?
And how did you feel as a Native chef? I mean, if I was a Native chef and, you know, seeing different restaurants resurrect or bring these or, like, rediscover these flavors, like, I'm right here. I'm a Native chef. I mean, what do you feel? Do you feel, like, overlooked or just kind of disrespected knowing that these people are, like, rediscovering this food that you've been cooking, that we've been cooking forever?
I mean, I have multiple feelings about it. You know, one, my career spans a good portion of media, right? And I'm fairly well known. So I know that that information is out there, right? You look at chefs in this light that are out here doing this and on a larger scale, you know, and so the information's out there. But then you have to look at myself as a chef coming up in the industry. You are very self-absorbed with, like, what you're doing, right? Like, you're not outside of that. You're working 80 to 100 hours a week. You're coming up with these theories and ideas and this, that, and the other. So you're not really looking.
Hey, Carlos, we're going to have to go to a break here in just a couple seconds, but we want to start that up after the break. But we're talking about food appropriation here on Native America Calling. You can join us after the break. The sun provides free, renewable energy every day, all day. It isn't the primary source of energy in the U.S., but things are changing. On the next Native America Calling, we'll look at several tribal programs aimed at bringing solar power into communities that help sustain both energy development and jobs. We hope you'll join us.
Dance waking up. Program support from AmeriCorps Vista. AmeriCorps Vista members make a difference in the fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining valuable skills. We have rewarding service opportunities around the country, focusing on economic opportunity, healthy futures, education, and more. It will change your life and the lives of others. Information at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA. The third National Gathering of American Indian Veterans, celebrating all U.S. military, takes place July 21st through the 23rd at Cantigny Park in Wheaton, Illinois. Visitors will hear World War II code talker stories, witness or participate in a Vietnam veterans pinning ceremony, and enjoy native bands and dancers. Information on events and lodging by calling 847-301-2090 or at trickstergallery.com. Proud to support this program.
Welcome back. You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy from Navajo Nation. Wurrawo Komoko opened last November in California. It's a restaurant based on a place in Virginia, and it was created by Francis Ford Coppola, the director of the Godfather films and many others. On the menu are foods like fried bread tacos, bison burgers, wild rice salad, and green chili stew. Wurrawo Komoko is a place important to the Pamunkey and other tribes in Virginia. And on the restaurant's website, it says the Pamunkey Tribal Council approved of the name. I talked to the Pamunkey chief, Robert Gray, and he said Coppola did ask permission to use the name Wurrawo Komoko. He said it was a name that could be used freely, and he was glad that at least Coppola asked. Does permission from one or more Native people make it right? Is there a right way for a non-Native person to run a restaurant based on Native food and imagery, especially when there are so few Native restaurants out there? You can tell us what you think. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. And let's go to our caller here. We have an anonymous person in Gallup, New Mexico, listening on KGLP. Hello.
Hi.
Hello? You're on air.
Yeah, I have a comment. I enjoy all types of food. Okay. And from my tribe, we like to welcome the guests in with food. And anybody like to say that they love Native food, you know, that's fine. But that was about it.
Okay. All right. In Native America, we're very generous. We always have lots and lots of food to welcome people, to celebrate, to really do anything. We have lots of food to go around every day, every ceremony, every powwow. Let's go back to our guest. We had Carlos Baca. Carlos, before the break, you were talking about being overlooked, other restaurants claiming to, other people claiming to be the discoverer of Native food, or even maybe the expert. Go ahead and continue your comment there.
Right. So we're just talking about being locked in this bubble, this personal bubble, you know, which has even evolved more so with social media, right, to where everything is granted to your thought process, you know, the Facebook and the Google, and everything is tailor-making your vision around you. So people don't really see outside of their bubble. Right. But you would think in the food industry, where you have, you know, the Nephi Craigs and the Sean Shermans and the Claudia Serratos and the Brian Yazzies and, you know, this whole vast array of indigenous chefs, mm-hmm. that people would not attempt to do something like that. Right. Or they would at least invite someone to the table to learn or work with, or, you know, so it goes to that bigger problem in this whole discussion that with cultural appropriation. We're sitting here going, I was saying in a previous conversation about where do we differentiate capitalism and humanity? You know, like where does that lie? Like where is it as a person's responsibility to say that doesn't belong to me? Right. And so you're looking at the symptoms of the bigger socioeconomic scenario in this country, and Canada and Mexico, you know, all over the place. So it's a really tough one. You know, this is why we're having this discussion today and why we're going to continue having it.
And how does food appropriation affect you guys as chefs, if it even does that?
Well, I don't know that it. The effect is, like, what side of history are you going to be on, for one, right? The other side of that, to me, is. To go back to like what Claudia was saying, right? Like these recipes and these things, these are like stories and like family history and this ancestral memory and all these things that even if somebody had all my recipes, even if somebody does the food that I do, mm-hmm. it's not ever going to be my food. Right? Because like discussing with my kids, let's say, I make tortillas. They always judge them against my grandmother, right? Mm-hmm. Like, which obviously they're not ever going to be that good, right? Because there's that love and that's the main substance of the food itself, you know? And a grandmother's love and, you know, the love of a mother, it's just, you know, there's a reason that food is more of a matriarchal scenario, right? Like the caregiver and the all that love, you know. And I think when we look at it in the light, it's going to matter in the long run whether people are taking these foods and trying to create something else, right? If they're appropriating these recipes to open up, you know, whatever Francis Ford Coppola's scenario is. I don't even want to grace it with a name. But, you know, for myself personally, like it's a fight and a conversation that I'm going to stay in. Mm-hmm. But I know because of what my food is and what my food represents, it can't be taken away. All right. You know, and so... yeah, I mean, I guess that's where I stand with that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Carlos. Let's bring in Neftali Duran. He's a Oaxaca chef and he's Mixteco. Welcome to Native America Calling, Neftali.
Hi, Anna. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks for being here. So we're kind of getting into maybe working together, learning from each other. You have an interesting concept, culinary synergy. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So let's first lay down the groundwork for a cultural misappropriation. My opinion is that cultural appropriation is just a continuation of colonial thinking in which a dominant culture owns everything. And we have some, and I can name a couple of good examples. For example, in agriculture, a tortilla is not just a tortilla. A tortilla is the history of our peoples that took tens of thousands of years of innovation to come to a tortilla. For someone, let's say, like, you know, the Bell Company to create a company and make tons of money, selling a taco. You know, that is just a continuation of colonial thinking, where the dominant culture owns everything. The difference between that and something that I propose that is cultural synergy is for peoples in the Americas, indigenous peoples in the Americas, have always traded food with each other, food and ingredients. And if you just look at one ingredient, per se, the corn. We all have, most of indigenous cultures in the Americas have a creation story around corn, which means that we have a similar history, and we respect the ingredient. We respect not only the ingredient but also the history behind corn. cultural synergy, is something that I think of as oppressed people sharing with each other recipes and food and sitting at the table and creating new foods, as opposed to someone going down to Mexico or going down to the Southwest and coming back to their point of origin and opening a restaurant. That's the difference that I see in between cultural synergy and cultural appropriation. The economic part of this is extremely important to recognize. And I believe, so I heard this somewhere, if you want to see the dynamic between the economic realities of people working in restaurants, you start at the front of the house. And by the time you get to the back of the house, you'll basically see brown people making the least amount of money cooking the food. Yet they're the ones making the less amount of money. So there is great economic implications. It's not only a restaurant. It mirrors a system of inequality.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. So, Neftali, you kind of got to it just a little bit. People of color in the restaurant business. Can you maybe explain a little more and maybe even talk about why we're not starting our own? I mean, people are starting Native restaurants and they're not Native, but, you know, could we just do it ourselves?
I mean, first of all, so all of us have been sold this dream that only if you pull yourself by your bootstraps, you would be able to do anything in this society. And the reality is that is not true. You know, what if you weren't born without boots? So you don't have bootstraps. Translate that into agriculture and food. We don't have access to land, which means that one of the ways this society built wealth throughout many generations is having land. Anyone that has wealth in this country, the very beginning of that wealth was by the displacement of Native people and then the enslavement of African American brothers and sisters. So if you start from that historical perspective, of course we don't have access to capital to start our own businesses, to own land, to grow our own food, not only because we live in a marginalized society in which we are segregated, but we live in a society that persistently has denied access to land and capital.
All right. Cool. Well, thanks for that, Neftali. I wanted to get to Loretta Barrett Odin, too. She's a Potawatomi chef from Oklahoma and the creator and host of Seasoned with Spirit, A Native Cook's Journey, which is an award-winning PBS miniseries. Loretta, you were, sort of partnering up there with Francis Ford Coppola to sort of check off a couple of things there at Woro Wokomoko. Can you tell me what your involvement was in that restaurant there?
Yes, but before I do that, I would like to comment. Everyone on this call, they're colleagues of mine. We've all worked together in the kitchen, so hello and greetings to all of you. Talking about owning restaurants, Andy, you had talked about in our phone conversation a comment that I had made regarding the Toasted Sister episode, and reminded me of what I said. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about people not having access or a way to open a restaurant, my son Clay and I, we're both Potawatomi, opened a restaurant in Santa Fe, New Mexico in 1993, featuring the indigenous foods of the Americas. Our foods were quite authentic. It may have been too long ago for some of our younger participants to remember. But that restaurant was in Santa Fe for 10 years, first in a little freestanding location, and second iteration was at the Hotel Santa Fe, which is owned by the Picarice Pueblo of New Mexico. So That being said, you know, I am Potawatomi. I grew up with food. I grew up with planting and growing in a small town just southeast of Oklahoma City. Food is really my language of love. It's my grand passion, and people who write about such things suggest that, you know, each and every one of us has primary means by which we communicate and receive love. And they don't typically include food on their lists of love languages, but I, as a woman, a mother, a grandmother, there's nothing that brings me more pleasure than working in the kitchen to prepare meals for the people I care about. And doing so is the primary way that I show people that I love them. And this goes to a broader audience of my, you know, my guests in my restaurants. It's also a very great responsibility. It's about heightening people's awareness of who we are as Native people, that we are still here. My food speaks to that. You know, I'm a nurturer. I try to keep my people healthy to the best of my ability, of my knowledge, the availability of the foods that I prepare. And so getting into, you know, the most essential human endeavor is the acquisition and the preparation of food. And that's what I've been doing for most of my life, from childhood on, in the gardens and with my grandmothers and my mother and my aunties. And I feel that I have a pretty good grasp of what Native American food is, what the indigenous foods of the Americas are. And I use that as a tool, as I said, to heighten people's awareness that we are still here. We have not gone anywhere. So back to Werowocomoco, Francis Ford Coppola's restaurant in Geyserville, California, that he opened, last November, with quite a backlash on social media, quite an extraordinarily negative backlash on social media. While I think that he did gain some, you know, approval from the Pamunkey tribe, first of all, let me say that, you know, Francis is a storyteller, as we all know. He's been around for a long time. The whole story of the Virginia Dare winery, Werowocomoco, came from the East Coast, from something that he heard, you know, on the radio years ago as a kid. Whatever that story involves, he thought that he would create this Werowocomo restaurant. He's been pretty much accepted by the Pomo peoples, that are the peoples of that particular part of Northern California where the restaurant and the winery exist. A lot of even the Sonoma wine people gave him some flack about bringing an East Coast wine, an East Coast wine grape, the old Scuppernong grape, which is indigenous, by the way, of bringing that back to Sonoma. Mm-hmm. The story, the reason I was brought in was that was after all of that backlash. I was on his board of advisors very early on. Then I was called in after that kind of, you know, social media mess to see what I could do to kind of smooth some of that over. It is a hard story sometimes to join the Virginia Dare Winery, which is the first white colonial baby girl born on the East Coast, you know, all of that story, that, and then bring that into the restaurant Werowocomoco. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with that, because I think that when we talk about cultural appropriation, I don't really take that much offense in the food world, because, you know, food is so central to who we are, where we are. We take, as Claudia said, These recipes come from our grandmother's hands, our great-grandmother's hands, our mother's hands, that knowledge of food preparation. But we are now, this is a global thing. You know, food is a coming together of people. I don't think of any better way to try and make peace with the rest of the world than to share a meal. How do you better learn about a culture, another's culture, than to share the meal? In Indian country, we are extremely generous with our food. There's always a pot of soup or stew, or there's food to share. That sitting down, and I'm a woman of some age. I'm not a confrontational person, and I have rather gentle ways of trying to get my message across. Mm-hmm. And I do that through the food. You know, my restaurant in Santa Fe was one that was, you know, relatively a newer concept to a lot of the people in that area, a Native American foods restaurant, what do we expect, and all of that. And it really ignited a wonderful conversation at that time when I would be called out of the kitchen to come and explain to someone, well, we had no idea, you know, the origins of tomatoes and chocolate and vanilla and all of that. So it really sparked a dialogue back in the early 90s of just what is indigenous food? How does it speak to our culture? And wow, we didn't know that. And it's really unfortunate that that is the case in this country, that so few people know the true history of our people in this country. So my take is that I use the food to try in a very gentle way to inform people.
Okay. Well, even through Wuro Wo Kumoko, I mean, Francis Ford Coppola is not Native. I mean, to me, it sounds like maybe that's okay for him to tell our story. I mean, what else do you want to say about our food stories and our maybe some of our identity and some of that love being told through this restaurant that was made by a non-Native person?
I have a really big problem with saying any one person can open a for instance, Nathalie, you had a bakery up in Massachusetts, Le Jardin. What did you bake there? You know, is not making challah and French batards and country breads with rosemary and olive oil, all of that, is that not kind of a reverse form of cultural appropriation?
Neftali, did you want to respond?
Sure. Absolutely not. That is not cultural appropriation, because wheat came to my people in 1520, and after about 100 years of genocide and the destruction of thousands of years of agriculture, agricultural innovation, we were left with wheat, a product that not only we couldn't digest, but also a product that became a colonial commodity for European people to eat in a feudal society, mind you. So I used to call something that was brought to me by colonialism and made a living out of it. My grandpa was a baker, and his grandfather was a baker, amongst also being a farmer. So no, I don't see that as a cultural appropriation, because there is no such thing as an appropriation of when you are an oppressed people.
Right. Well, I just, you know, I have every admiration for your talent and the work that you do. The same with Carlos. Carlos worked with a, you know, very, very wonderful, gorgeous resort and restaurant up in Colorado. He did a lot of non-Indigenous foods because that was required of him because of the people he worked with. I just don't think that in the world of food, that cultural appropriation is, I opened this restaurant. It was in existence in Santa Fe for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I didn't use white wheat flour. I didn't use processed sugars. You know, all of that. It just seems to me that via the trade routes, food has traveled around the world. What about a coconut floating across the ocean from one land and one culture to another? Is that cultural appropriation in the food world that one uses that coconut? You look at Mexican food. You look at Colombian food. You look at any of the foods from any region. We have we have adopted ingredients like cilantro and wild rice and chicken and pork, you know, pork pibil. We didn't have pigs in the Americas. We didn't have chickens in the Americas. And yet that has become an integral part of a lot of our indigenous cuisines. Right. So I think it speaks to our adaptability, our creativity, and I can speak to cultural appropriation when it comes to our ceremony, our regalia, the movies and all of that. But I think food is a little bit different because food is about sharing. Women always share recipes. Claudia talked about cookbooks. I know there are a few in our group of Native chefs that are coming out with cookbooks. It's that sharing, that's putting those recipes and those foodstuffs and those ingredients out there.
All right. All right. Well, we have reached the end of the hour. I would like to say thanks to all our guests. We mentioned Claudia Serrato, who we heard from in the first half, Natalie Duran, Carlos Baca, and Loretta Barrett-Oden. Loretta earlier mentioned Toasted Sister. That is a podcast that I started. It is a podcast about Native American food. So if you're interested in, you know, listening to more conversations with Native chefs, Toasted Sister, you can find that on the net. We'll be back next. We'll be back tomorrow with a discussion about solar power in Native America.
Keshe, yamisto medico cause alite na tu. Lukia olo ikena yamato na to medicate that the cheap an arch na tu. 1-800-318-2596 and pen and arch na. That is medicate.gov in Donawa doa. Lukia centers for Medicare and Medicaid services Donawa pen and itu loke na we. Ela kwa.
Support by the Sioux Trading Post, where our special selection of dried herbs are chosen for superior quality, and many sage, sweetgrass braids, red willow bark, and cedar are wildcrafted. All available at SiouxTrading.com. Wopila.
Yate, the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the 2017 Navination Insurance Safety and Health Conference, July 31st to August 2nd. Info on this event and services at siabq.org. Hakoanet.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.